welcome to the reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette for November the 29th. I'm your reader, Will Potter. Let's start off today with the article, COVID Enforcement Heats Up. State regulators going tougher on restaurants and bars violating policies. After a slow start, state regulators have stepped up their enforcement of public health orders related to bars and restaurants during the COVID-19 pandemic, state records show. Earlier this fall, hundreds of complaints were filed, but only two actions were taken in the first month after state agencies announced a plan to crack down on bars and restaurants that violate the state's COVID-19-related public health orders. Over 3 months from August through October, however, the state issued 24 citations for COVID-19 policy infractions, state records show. A spokesman for the Iowa Alcoholic Beverages Division, the primary agency responsible for enforcement of regulations governing restaurants and bars, said the agency had received roughly 650 COVID-19-related complaints, completed more than 2,500 inspections, and opened 59 cases. ABD continues to conduct inspections and investigations when warranted, Jake Holmes, a spokesman for the agency, said in an emailed response to questions. The vast majority of establishments that we visit appear to be in compliance with the governor's proclamations. There are a small amount of establishments that are not complying, and they are being held accountable. Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds, in conjunction with the state public health department, has issued multiple public health proclamations throughout the COVID-19 pandemic, which first reached Iowa in late March. The orders have always required restaurants and bars to enact social distancing in order to minimize patrons being close to each other in an effort to limit the virus's spread, but for many months the state did not enforce those social distancing requirements. On July 30th, the state Alcoholic Beverages Division and Department of Inspections and Appeals announced a joint effort to enforce the public health orders by issuing fines and citations. But in the first month, the agencies took only two actions amid more than 350 complaints. At the time, a spokesperson for ABD said the investigations can be time-consuming and said the division was attempting to work through the complaints as quickly as possible while also ensuring due process. That pace picked up from August through October, state records show. The state issued 24 citations. Of those 24 citations, 14 resulted in a penalty or settlement, most of which included a $1,000 fine, 2 were dismissed, and 8 were still open, awaiting a final action. The citations were issued in cities across Iowa, including Des Moines, Council Bluffs, Mason City, and more. Our staff has done a great job of enforcing the governor's proclamations, Holmes said. Holmes said the investigations are the result of a myriad of reporting sources. Roughly 60% came from inspections, 30% from a complaint, and 10% from other enforcement agencies like local police and sheriff departments. Jessica Dunker, president and CEO of the Iowa Restaurant Association, which represents and advocates for restaurants and bars across the state, said most venues are doing the right things to comply with COVID-19 public health policies. She said the industry welcomed the increased enforcement because venues found targeted enforcement of bad actors preferable to widespread shutdowns early in the pandemic. It's just a reminder to people we called for that authority to be given to state regulators, because we were incredibly frustrated as an industry by blanket closures that impacted people who were doing everything right, Dunker said. We're certainly worried for operators that this happens to, but we believe they will pay the fine or do whatever they are asked to do, and that moving forward they will fall in line with the restrictions that they are being asked to do. You're not finding many complaints from industry about that. The greater frustration has always been competing with people who aren't playing the same sort of rules that you are. The vast majority of people have played by the rules and have been given to us. Dunker said the food service industry continues to suffer greatly from the pandemic. She said projections suggest the state will lose net 1,000 locations over the course of 1 year, a drop of roughly 16%. And she said the industry is projected to lose roughly $1 billion, a 23% drop from the $4.4 billion it was projected to earn this year. "It's glum, I'm not going to lie," Dunker said. Dunker encouraged Iowans to take advantage of restaurants and bars' extended services, like drive-through and takeout orders. Holmes encouraged venues to comply with public health orders and, when in doubt, to request guidance from state agencies. He also encouraged customers to help venues by complying with those public health orders, most of which are focused on keeping patrons from separate groups at least 6 feet apart. "To the establishments that are complying, thank you. Please continue to do so. The establishments that choose not to comply will be held accountable," Holmes said. Now let's move on to the article, "The Future of Our Pandemic-Acquired Vices." Life in lockdown during the coronavirus pandemic has cast the idea of staying in and staying safe as a noble activity. Stick to a virtual life and you will also be leading a virtuous one. But that's not entirely true. Our lockdown COVID-19 lives are heavy on vice. In-home consumption of alcohol and cannabis are up. Americans are eating more chocolate, watching more pornography, and now that football season is underway, gambling more on sports. So will the changes the virus has wrought continue if the world finally pulls itself out of the COVID muck? Will post-vaccine life return to pre-pandemic normalcy, or will we think back on 2020 with a 1974 Doobie Brothers album titled in mind, "What Were Once Vices Are Now Habits"? COVID-19 anxiety has brought about unprecedented demand for medical and recreational marijuana, said Christiana Visco, CEO of the Terra Vidia Holistic Centers, a chain of cannabis dispensaries in the Philadelphia suburbs. "I've been in this business for a long time," says Visco, who's known as the Queen of Cannabis, "but I've never had so many requests from people who want to get their cards. It's a mainstream America. Doctors, lawyers, stockbrokers, just regular people that may not have considered it before that are anxious. People have a lot of stress and they're looking for stress relievers. Patients are smoking more and vaping less," Visco said, "because they're at home and they don't want to hide the odor. And they don't have to hide the odor. Increased use during the COVID-19 pandemic makes the legalization of recreational weed more likely in the near future," Visco says. It's a $21 billion industry. Grandma is using it now. You can't put the genie back into the bottle. The same likely holds for gambling. Early in the pandemic, casinos and sports were shut down, and gamblers were frustrated by the lack of attention, says addiction counselor Arnie Wexler, author of All Bets Are Off: Losers, Liars, and Recovery from Gambling Addiction. When professional sports returned, New Jersey set a record with $748 million in sports bets in September. Wexler worries about first-time gamblers who bet initially on their cell phones. "In the pandemic, some people will try it out of boredom," Wexler said. "Every time you expand gambling to get people to try it that have never gambled before, some of them get hooked." In September, a RAND Corp study found that the frequency with which Americans older than 30 used alcohol jumped 14% in May and June compared to the last year. Sociologist Michael S. Pollard, who headed the study, says it also found that frequency of drinking among women went up 14% and binge drinking among women increased by 41%. Those numbers aren't completely surprising because adult women have more responsibilities at home, and women in general, and women of color in particular, are more likely to be high-stress frontline workers, according to the National Women's Health Network, an advocacy group in Washington. So does that mean that when people can go out to bars and restaurants like they used to, that women will stop slamming back booze at home? Not necessarily. Women have been exiting the labor force in larger proportions than men, Pollard said. It could be harder for them to get back in. They could be trapped in a worse position than before in the pandemic, and that could potentially elevate their alcohol use. How things play out depend partly on the level of the economic wreckage from the virus after it's brought under control, he says. While alcohol can be used to cope with stress and depression, it also creates this feedback loop that can increase depression that can continue to spiral. Whether bad habits lead us down a road to ruin, or we can lead to fulfilling lives despite them during and after COVID-19 will depend in part on individual responses to the pandemic, said Martin E.P. Seligman, director of the Positive Psychology Center at the University of Pennsylvania. Seligman sees the psychological toll of the pandemic as a continuum, with people suffering from mental illness on one end and those happily flourishing on the other. In between are the people languishing through the pandemic, who could be said to be guilty of the vice of sloth, one of Dante's seven deadly sins in Inferno. There's been a drop of people from flourishing to languishing, Seligman says, and that's a real concern to me. Even if you don't become depressed, your relationships suffer, your work suffers. One key to combating that spiritual malaise, says Seligman, is knowing what brings you joy and putting things in perspective. During the pandemic, the Penn professor has not only gotten himself a puppy, but he's also been listening to a lot of the Berlin Philharmonic and Meatloaf. Some pandemic indulging, like chocolate or gambling or porn, Seligman says, is surely seeking joy. Some of it is likely boredom and languishing. Pulling ourselves out of the COVID-19 morass, Seligman says, is dependent on hope and optimism. If you're pessimistic and you believe nothing that you do matters, you're not going to come out of this epic episode in human history very well. Now let's move on to the article, CDC, Pregnancy Raises Risk of COVID Death. An analysis of more than 400,000 women between 15 and 44 years old and diagnosed with COVID-19 revealed that those who were pregnant had a 70% increased risk of dying compared to those who were not, according to the Center for Disease Control and Prevention. Invasive ventilation, intensive care unit administration by ECMO, were also more common among pregnant than non-pregnant women. ECMO stands for extracorporeal membrane oxygenation. It's a procedure that removes blood from your body, runs it through a machine that clears it of carbon dioxide, and inserts oxygen-rich blood back into the body. The new study comes after an earlier report from June that found similar results on pregnant women and COVID-19, except for an increased risk of death from the disease. Pregnant women who are 35 to 44 years old and positive for COVID-19 were nearly four times as likely to require invasive ventilation and twice as likely to die than non-pregnant women of the same age. What's more, Hispanic women had 2.4 times the risk of death. Understanding the risk posed by SARS-CoV-2 infection in pregnant women can inform clinical practice, risk communication, and medical countermeasures allocation, the report reads. Pregnant women should be informed of their risk for severe COVID-19-associated illness and the warning signs of severe COVID-19. Between January 22nd and October 3rd, about 409,000 women in the case study had symptomatic COVID-19, including 23,434 pregnant women, 34 of whom died, equaling 1.5 deaths per 1,000 cases. Of the 386,028 non-pregnant women who tested positive for COVID-19, another 447 died from the coronavirus complications, or 1.2 deaths per 1,000 cases, the CDC says. Researchers say these numbers could be explained by physiologic changes that occur during pregnancy, such as an increased heart rate, higher oxygen consumption, decreased lung capacity, increased risk of blood clot formation, and weakened immune systems. And although black women made up just 14% of the women included in the analysis, they made up about 27% of deaths among those who were pregnant and about 37% of deaths among those who were not pregnant. Meanwhile, Asian and Native Hawaiian/Pacific pregnant women were of particularly increased risk for ICU admission. Younger pregnant women between 15 and 24 years old faced triple the risk of receiving invasive ventilation compared with non-pregnant women of the same age. To minimize the risk for acquiring SARS-CoV-2 infection, pregnant women should limit unnecessary interactions with persons who might have been exposed to or are infected with the SARS-CoV-2, including those within their households, as much as possible, the report reads. While going out or interacting with others, pregnant women should wear a mask, social distance, avoid persons who are not wearing a mask, and frequently washing their hands. In addition, pregnant women should take measures to ensure their general health, including staying up to date with annual influenza vaccination and prenatal care. Now, let's move on to the article, Biden's Diversity Policies May Line Up with Corporate America's. In a twist, companies probably will find themselves more in line with the diversity and inclusion policies of President-elect Joseph Biden than with departing administration of Donald Trump. Part of the explanation can be found in the upending of the traditional alliance of business and Republican administrators. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce, Business Roundtable, and large companies such as Microsoft Corp. have been at odds with Trump's Labor Department and other regulators on workplace policy. Outrage over the killing of George Floyd and the disproportionately high death rate of black Americans from COVID-19 have led many companies to expand programs to promote workplace fairness, drawing opposition from the Trump administration. Biden is expected to quickly dispense with some Trump policies, said James Plunkett, the former director for labor law policy at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. Biden's comments during the Biden campaign suggests he will push for more pay transparency and a tougher line on diversity among federal contractors, who employ about a quarter of U.S. workers, he said. Some people now believe that firms have a social role, said Scott Yonker, a professor of economics at Cornell University. And even if there aren't regulations, then the corporation should have a soul, and that's what's right. The shift in thinking, it's a departure from the more traditional approach from business and Republicans popularized by economist Milton Friedman, who argued that the role of a company is to maximize shareholder returns within the current regulatory environment, Yonker said. In response to pressure from investors and activists, the Business Roundtable, a group of the largest company chief executive officers, said late last year that it was breaking with 50 years of Friedman-style policy, and members would now aim to take into account the interests of employees and society. In contrast, Trump's Labor Department chastised Microsoft and Wells Fargo & Co. for setting hiring targets for black executives, started a hotline to root out diversity training and deemed discriminatory to white employees, and established rules to make it more difficult for large pension funds to advocate for social change if their initiatives do not promote maximizing retirement returns. One limitation will be the control of Congress. If Republicans retain their majority in the U.S. Senate, a fate that will be decided in two Georgia runoff elections in January, Biden will be limited to executive orders that were the mainstay of the second half of both Barack Obama and Trump's presidencies. Trump issued 196 executive orders through late October, and Obama issued 295, according to a report by the employment law firm Littler's Workplace Policy Institute shortly after the November 3rd election. Some of Biden's workplace initiatives may also be delayed by a need to focus on the record number of new COVID-19 infections, the Littler report said. There are a lot of folks going back to their files or refreshing their recollection from the Obama administration, said Plunkett, now the senior government relations counsel with law firm Ogletree Dinkins. It's no secret that policy never really dies in Washington. A Biden administration will, at a minimum, return to Obama-era policies, said Maya Rahu. My apologies for a mispronunciation there. The director of workplace equality in the senior counsel at the National Women's Law Center. The list of potential Biden advisors includes former Equal Employment Opportunity Commission Chair Jenny Yang, former Solicitor of Labor Patricia Smith, and other well-known faces in the workplace policy sphere. There are deep structural problems with our economy and in our workplaces that can't be addressed in small steps, Rayu said. Biden will also likely revisit the definition of what it is a contractor and who is an employee, a key debate for companies such as Uber Technologies Incorporated and Lyft Incorporated, says Laura Mitchell, a principal with the law firm Jackson Lewis. Another area to get a fresh look will be the rules on religious freedom and other diversity topics in the workplace, she said. The Biden administration may also push for more transparency on company labor violations and pay disparities, which were initiatives under Obama and sometimes incurred a company resistance, she said. A more progressive labor policy may also prompt employees to be more assertive in their claims, Mitchell said. The full impact won't be clear until Biden makes key workplace appointments, such as the Labor Secretary, the Labor Department's top attorney, and sub-agency heads, Mitchell said. Folks kind of understand that there is going to be a lot of wholesale kind of shift of the winds, and so they are just waiting to see. Now let's read a few more local articles. Let's start with Mason City Nonprofit Works to Guide Parents. Dads with a Purpose helps families battling drug and alcohol problems. When Mason City native Kevin Valentine was in the thick of his drug and alcohol problems, usually using rent money to buy methamphetamine and going in and out of jail, he couldn't have imagined where he'd be now. Those problems were a constant for him. At the age of 7, when he was largely being raised by his older brother, Valentine said that he was taking sips of Crown Royal in the purple drawstring bag. By 20, Valentine said that he tried meth for the first time, and it got its hooks into him. From there, it was a string of jail stays and failed treatments while seeing more and more of his family, especially his older children, want to spend less and less time around him. I did not see that drugs and alcohol were the problem. Everything else around me was the problem. It was always someone else, Valentine said. Eventually, Valentine was able to get clean about 5.5 years ago, and while he was in treatment, someone raised the idea to him about a sober living house that would allow for children to visit. The idea was compelling enough for Valentine that he used the connections he'd made to see if such a thing could work. Now Valentine is working as the housing director for Dads with a Purpose, a nonprofit with homes in Mason City and Des Moines that aims to provide parents who have struggled with drugs and alcohol the tools and support they need to take part in their children's lives. In the past, if someone said Kevin Valentine works with a sober living house, that would have been a joke all over town, Valentine said. I'd been to prison, in and out of jail, and in and out of treatment centers. But what I chose to do is to give up my will and follow a different direction. In Mason City, Valentine said that Dads with a Purpose works with a group of interrelated organizations such as B.J. Clark Residential Center and Prairie Ridge Integrated Behavioral Health Care to give those who might otherwise live in a halfway house another option. There are currently 8 men living in the house in Mason City, and they're expected to get a sponsor and work a 12-step program as well as find employment. With that, the residents are allowed to have guests at the house, but only in the common area. The house supervisor in Mason City is Jason Hoff, who's been working with Dads with a Purpose for going on 10 months now. Like Valentine, Hoff said he couldn't have imagined doing something like this in the past when he was going through the worst of his struggles. It could have been so much different if I had something like this 10, 15 years ago, Hoff said. However, I'm just grateful for the program today and what it stands for and what I can give back to some of the younger guys. Valentine said that he's incredibly happy to see people like Hoff find purpose through leading by example. Seeing his life change is just amazing, Valentine said. That sort of joy is something Valentine had experienced plenty of times since he started the path with Dads with a Purpose. He gets to witness countless personal revelations by people trying to do better. And he gets to do it with family and friends. One of his daughters and her husband's do work with Dads for a Purpose as well. As this particular moment in time, with the holidays in full swing and a pandemic and economic downturn causing a lot of anger and depression, Valentine said he's especially happy to get to do this work. To have the sober living house and the karmadari they create is extremely beneficial and much needed, because with this, we can uplift each other and show each other that there's another alternative. Now, let's go on to the article, Iowans Travel Down from 2019, but movement has increased lately as a virus surge worsens. Iowans have, for the most part, been traveling less throughout the COVID-19 pandemic than they did at the same time last year, multiple data sources show. However, Iowans have been much more mobile recently, even while the virus has been spreading worse than it has at any point during the pandemic, the data shows. Over the course of the pandemic, from March 13th to November 19th, travel on Iowa's roads decreased nearly 20% over the same dates as the previous year, according to data compiled by the State Transportation Department. However, travel on Iowa's roads dropped by nearly 60% in early April during the early stages of the pandemic. More recently, over the most recent week that data was available, travel on Iowa's roads is down just 17%, according to the state data. That is while in Iowa, over just the past month, the 14-day average number of new cases has quadrupled, the number of daily hospitalizations has tripled, and the 14-day average of new deaths has doubled. In other words, Iowans are traveling more recently when compared to the same time in the previous year than they did during the early stages of the pandemic, even though the COVID-19 pandemic has been spreading throughout the state and recently at rates never before seen. And during the month of September and into early October, travel on Iowa's secondary roads was actually higher than it was on the same dates the year before, according to the state's data. A State Transportation Department official cautioned against drawing broad conclusions from travel data on specific types of roads because it can be impacted by a myriad of factors, including weather and agricultural influences. There are no travel restrictions among the state's public health orders for the COVID-19 pandemic. But public health experts have continuously urged people to distance themselves from others as much as possible by keeping at least 6 feet away from people when possible and wearing face masks in public. The Federal Center for Disease Control and Prevention says travel increases a person's chance of getting and spreading the virus, and that staying home is the best way to prevent that. The CDC says that people should not travel if they are infected with COVID-19, are sick, or if they have been around someone with COVID-19 over the past 2 weeks. Now for Titanium Lunchbox Goes Mobile. Owners of Brit Restaurant Unveil New Food Truck. Owners of the Titanium Lunchbox Restaurant in Brit have always had plans to open a food truck in due time. With COVID-19 gripping North Iowa, those plans were put on the front burner. Damien and Catherine Baker, along with their son Josh, say the new top-of-the-line food truck is open for business to bring hot and fresh pizza, pasta, and virtually all other food items on the restaurant's menu to its customers. The owners feel the truck is just what their restaurant needs in the current COVID-19 outbreak. "We've always had plans to do a food truck, but COVID kind of sped that up," said Damien Baker. "People are wanting their food provided in a safe manner for whatever activities and events. We can bring it fresh and hot." The restaurant is celebrating its 10th year in business on December 10th. It is located at 62 Main Avenue North in Britt. Baker thanked the Britt community for its support and for making the business venture so successful. "We can cater pretty much anything for any event," Baker said. The Titanium Lunchbox restaurant will be serving Thanksgiving dinner from 10:30 a.m. to 1:30 p.m. on November 26th. It will be carryout or delivery only. The truck will also be used to feed Michael Foods and Spabo Farm employees this Thanksgiving due to COVID-19 restrictions. "I never thought we'd have to close the inside of the restaurant to customers. But with pizza, we've always did a lot of carryout, which is a booming business now," said Baker. The food truck was built new in Tennessee, and the bakers designed the specifications themselves. The truck has a food preparation table, 4-deck oven, dough mixer, and sheeter fryers, refrigerators, 3-compartment sink, and a large serving window. All equipment is restaurant grade, Baker said. The oven decks and fryers run on propane gas. Baker said the restaurant closed for the second time on November 13th, noting it was fitting that it was Friday the 13th. He noted how grateful they are for ha about having a new food truck amidst the shutdowns. Their regular menu includes pizza, calzones, sandwiches, burgers, tenderloins, pasta, wraps, subs, and appetizers. They have 54 specialty pizzas, with the 5-meat and combination pizzas selling well, and chicken broccoli Alfredo and a wild hog pizza with jalapenos being popular along with calzones. We cooked with the oven in the new truck last week, and it worked really well, said Baker. We're running a restaurant on wheels. He noted that food preparation is about the same in the truck, and so are food safety inspections. The truck is required to have a home base, which is the restaurant, but the bakers plan to take it to their widening base of customers as much as possible. You are listening to the reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette for November the 29th on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. Phyllis E. Ballard. Phyllis E. Ballard, June 22, 1936 to November 23, 2020. Phyllis Elaine Ballard of Mason City, Iowa, passed away peacefully on Monday, November 23, 2020. A celebration of life and graveside service will be held in June of 2021. Phyllis was born on June 22, 1936, to Fred and Pearl Elfs in Buffalo Center, Iowa. She graduated from Rake High School in May of 1953. She then moved to Opelousas, Louisiana, where she met the love of her life, Stanley Ballard, and they married on January 24, 1955. Together, they had two children, Larry James and Carol Jean. Phyllis had various jobs over the years, retiring from Sears and Roebuck in 1996 after over 35 years of service. She was then able to travel. The most memorable places were to her were Hawaii, Maine, Texas, Mississippi, Louisiana, and last but not least, Graceland. She loved visits from her grandchildren, and each summer they made special by the family time she spent in Rudd, Iowa. Hogan Bremer Moore Colonial Chapel, 126 3rd Street, Northeast Mason City. Their phone number is 641-423-2372. Gerald Lee Schultz. Gerald Lee Schultz, 83, of Clear Lake, died Monday, November 23, 2020, at Mercy One North Iowa Medical Center in Mason City. A graveside service will be held at 11 a.m. Monday, November 30, 2020, at Clear Lake Cemetery, where military honors will be provided by the Clear Lake VFW Post 4868 Honor Guard. Memorial contributions may be sent to the family at 1618 Poplar PL, Clear Lake, Iowa, or 50428. Gerald was born June 29, 1937, the son of Carl and Mary Schultz in Red Oak, Iowa. He was raised in Mason City and graduated from Mason City High School in 1956. On June 30, 1957, he married Karen Hanley at the Little Brown Church in Nashua. After accepting a position with Great Lakes Pipeline, Gerald and Karen moved to Chippewa Falls, Wisconsin, Superior, Wisconsin, and Cloquet, Minnesota, following an invitation to join the United States Army in 1960. He moved to Germany and returned home in 1962. Gerald rejoined the pipeline and also decided to relocate to rural Superior, where he began raising mink and fox, which he continued for 38 years. In 1966, they welcomed a son, Stuart. Throughout his life, Gerald met buyers from all over the world, as well as several ranchers from the U.S. and Canada. He retired from the pipeline in 1979. As if their schedules weren't full enough, Gerald and Karen began selling feed to dog mushers. Their property became known as Sled Dog Central because mushers from all over the world would visit and even stay. They would always leave with a full stomach, though. The family returned to Clear Lake in 2002. Gerald was never one to go to other people's homes, but always enjoyed entertaining at his. He never missed a chance to chop, peel, and even eat. He had his group of ladies to help, and together they had a lot of fun. Gerald was a member of the Acacia Itasca FNAM in Superior, Wisconsin, and Clear Lake VFW Post 4868. He loved to hunt, fish, ice fish, and trap. Some of his favorite memories were fishing trips to Alaska. Left to cherish his memory is his wife of 63 years, Karen Schultz of Clear Lake, son Stuart John, brother Richard Schultz of Riceville, sisters Phyllis Mutziger of East Moline, sister Carla Schultz of Riverside, cousin George Kramer of Alden, sister-in-law Shirley Zinn of Joplin, and several nieces, nephews, and friends. Everyone that visited the house he considered family and was always happy to see him. He was preceded in death by his parents and nephew, Stephen Schultz. Gerald would appreciate ending with "Don't be a stranger," just as he did many conversations over the years. Ward Van Slyke Colonial Chapel, 310 First Avenue North, Clear Lake. Phone number is 641-357-2193. Dorothy Ahrens of 85 of Mason City died on Monday, November 23rd, 2020 at County Meadow Place. A private family graveside service will be held on Monday, November 30th, 2020 with Pastor Clark Frederick of Messiah Lutheran Church officiating. The graveside service will be live-streamed on Major Eckerson's Funeral Home Facebook page at 10:30 a.m. on Monday, November 30th, 2020. Memorials can be directed to the family of Dorothy Ahrens. Cards can be sent to the Major Eckerson Funeral Home. Online condolences may be left for the family at www.majorecksonfuneralhome.com. Dorothy Ann Ahrens was born on November 12, 1935 in Mason City to parents Robert and Emily Verhelst DeBolt. Dorothy graduated from Mason City High School. On the 23rd of November in Albert Lea, Minnesota, she was united in marriage to Maynard Ahrens. The couple would later move to Plymouth, where she was a homemaker and enjoyed her family. Dorothy enjoyed crafting with friends from Mason City and Albert Lea. She was involved with the church as a Sunday school teacher, as well as being a 4-H leader. She will always be remembered for being a good cook, but most importantly, for always taking care of her family. Dorothy is survived by her children, Emily Althoff, Nancy Renegans, grandchildren Andrew Althoff, Katie Nelson, Daniel Renegans, Sarah Mason, and 15 great-grandchildren and nieces and nephews. She was preceded in death by her parents' husband, Maynard daughter, Theresa Arnold's brother, Leland DeBolt, sister, Margaret Lee. Arrangements are with Major Eckerson Funeral Home and Crematory, 111 North Pennsylvania Avenue, Mason City, Iowa. The code is 50401. The phone number is 641-423-0924. Now let's go on and read some sports stories. Let's start with a look into the challenges of COVID-19 during winter sports. There's an old cliche in sports that head coaches love to use. It can be used as a tiring message, but it's effective when communicating the viewpoint to the team about its future. That cliche? We're taking it one game at a time. Most of the time, reporters leave out old cliches and stories, but this upcoming winter sports season, that cliche has more meaning now than it maybe ever has. With the environment surrounding COVID-19 seemingly worsening every day, and the 14-day rolling average in North Iowa counties remaining high, there's potential that student athletes or coaches could be exposed to the virus. That translates to games being canceled or players missing time. You never know which game might be your last one in a season like this, Osage boys basketball coach Mike Braun said. You could have 3 games scheduled for the week and then play 1 or 2 of them. You might not play any of them. So yes, the old cliche of taking it game by game is more specific to this year. However, coaches and players are making sure they make the most out of the opportunity. Most coaches are making sure their players wear masks during practices, as long as Iowa guidelines state that if someone comes in contact with a positive case, the person who doesn't have COVID-19 won't have to quarantine, as long as both of the people are wearing masks when the time of contact occurs. Leyland Foster, head coach of Newman Catholic Wrestling, is requiring his wrestlers to mask up during practice, which poses challenges. A lot of people don't wrestle, but they've never tried to put something over their face while they're breathing heavy. It's extremely difficult, Foster said, but we are abiding by every guideline that is put out there. Foster also says he cleans his wrestling room before and after practice and sanitizes often. There's plenty of new guidelines that are required by the state associations, such as sanitizing basketballs and limiting player interaction. A proclamation put out earlier this month from Governor states that only 2 spectators per athlete are allowed in the gym to watch the game. Now let's read the article, Mohawks Keeping It 100. 100. That's the motto for the Mason City boys basketball team this year. 100% energy, 100% focus, and 100% execution. For Mohawks head coach Nick Trask, that motto seems to be the way he approaches everything. During practice, he can often be seen getting in the middle of the action, miming out what he wants to see down near the basket, giving pep talks to the players, and loudly yelling instructions over the sound of squeaking sneakers and thunderous footfalls. On the court this year, there are a lot of questions that may have yet to be answered for Mason City. Gone is the leading 2019 scorer, Jeffrey Scogan, along with assists leader Avery Melman. But the team does have a lot of talent returning to the court. In 2020, there are no seniors on varsity for the Mohawks. On defense, Mason City will be led by a pair of sophomores in David Wilmson and Cale Hulbert, while Corey Miner will be the go-to guy on offense. We're expecting Corey Miner to bear the load of the pace of our offense, Trask said. He doesn't always have to be our scorer, but he is the one that needs to get us to set up into what we are doing. He is going to have a little more leeway than what we normally have. He is really smart, heady type of player. We are going to put the ball in his hands, let him initiate the offense, and we've got some special things set up for him as well. Miner, though he is still just a junior, seems eager to take on the role as team leader. With fellow junior Carter Thomas, the Mohawks' leading rebounder a season ago, missing much of the season due to surgery, the burden falls heavy upon Miner's shoulders to lead his team into the light. The light being a better record than the 18-14 record the team had in each of the past 2 seasons. I like it, Miner said of his new role. I like more responsibility as a leader of the team. I just try to get our team going and get us in the right direction and win games. We're going to need a lot more guys to step up defensively, especially without Carter. We have a lot of good talent and a lot of good scorers. One newer piece that should have impact this season is junior Mike Willis. Willis, who led the school's football team with 4.5 tackles for loss on defense this past fall, will play down near the basket as the team's main rebound threat. Willis spent much last season on JV after moving to Mason City from Chicago. While he's a bit raw, as Trask put it, the coach is excited to see what his 6'4" junior can do with a little bit of coaching. He is real powerful and a great coachable kid, Trask said. He's a little raw, but we're going to definitely keep him near the basket. But I'll tell you what, if you put a rebound in his area, there is nobody that is going to get it but him. This season, Trask is asking his players to give it their all, because he knows that this year has not been a given. With COVID-19 continuing to spread, nothing is guaranteed. That's why he preaches 100% effort, more than ever. You just don't know when it will end. We tell our players every single day that it is every time we step on the court is a blessing, Trask said. If we get to practice today, that is a blessing for us. We're going to play with passion, excitement, and we're going to try to get better when we have it, because we just never know when we won't have it anymore. Now, let's read the article, 5 Winter Prep Sports Storylines to Watch. With fall sports finished and Thanksgiving now done, winter sports are here. Already, several girl basketball teams have started, and boys' hoops and wrestling begin soon. While most fans will have to watch from home due to COVID-19 attendance restrictions, there are plenty of interesting storylines to keep an eye out for this season. Number 1. Osage Girls Basketball Seeking Another State Title. This particular group of athletes is used to winning. In 2019, as members of the Osage volleyball team, the Green Devils lost in the state quarterfinals before storming back this season to dominate their way to a 34-2 record and a Class 3A state title. If that pattern holds, this will be a season to remember for the girls' basketball squad. Last season, the hoops team, led by senior Sydney Brandau and juniors Danny Johnson and Ellie Bobinet, went 24-3 and made it to the state finals where they lost to North Lynn. This year, Johnson and Bobinet, both also stars on the volleyball court, returned to lead a squad that lost 3 of its top 5 scorers to graduation. The pairs will be joined by fellow senior Megan Henson, Katie Smith, and Victoria Schwarting, with underclassmen Meredith Street, Claudia Oschenbrenner, and Cabre Sullivan also expected to make an impact. With a number 12 rating heading into the season, and with much of the team fresh off volleyball title, the Green Devils are a team to watch. Number 2. The Growth of Girls Wrestling. Last season, the IWCOA Girls Wrestling State Tournament nearly tripled in size over the inaugural 2019 event, and anybody in attendance in Waverly that weekend can tell you that there is no shortage of passion for the sport. As of now, though, Iowa is one of the 23 states that has still not officially sanctioned girls wrestling. Until that time, Globe Gazette area fans still have plenty of fantastic female wrestlers to support. Osage and Charles City are two schools that have delivered some standout performances. Osage's Emma Grimm came closest to an area championship last year, finishing second overall in the 126-pound division as the state tournament. Grimm had only been wrestling for 2 years when she fell to number 1 ranked Sydney Park in late January and will surely be motivated to come back even stronger in her third year on the mat. She knows what she's got to work on, Osage head coach Ryan Fank said after last year's state finals. She's ready to get to it, she says, next year is my time. Charles City had 4 wrestlers finish top 6 at state, led by then-freshman Lily Luft, who placed 4th overall. The Comets finished 2nd in the team standing behind Waverly Shellrock and returned to much of their lineup. Number 3. Bounce-back seasons for Rhodes and Nelson. 2 area wrestlers are looking for bounce-back seasons in 2020 in Clear Lake senior Sam Nelson and Mason City's Jace Rhodes. Both have wrestled at the state tournament, and both have dealt with injury-plagued seasons in the past. For Nelson, this will be his final chance at a long-awaited state title. Last year, he missed most of the season due to a torn thumb ligament and came back to make it all the way to the state quarterfinals. Rhodes, after finishing runner-up at the state his freshman year, placed fifth in 2020. Both Rhodes and Nelson are the lone returning state competitors of their respective squads, and both had ultimately disappointing finishes last year. Keep an eye on both of them. The pair have overcome injuries and adversity and are primed for podium finishes in Des Moines. Number 4. One last chance for Rachel Liar. Rachel Liar has been the leading scorer and star player for the West Hancocks girls basketball team for 3 full seasons now and has led the program 2 consecutive state tournament appearances. In 2019, the Eagles lost to Noel Fonda in the state title game in 2020, fell to North Lynn in the semifinals. Now, as a senior, Liar has one last chance to finally earn the first state title in program history before she goes on to play college ball at the University of Nebraska, Kearney. Both Liar and head coach Paul Sonius seem confident that the Eagles can get it done, even with the departure of standout rebounder Amanda Chisk. My apologies for a mispronunciation there. "We are not going to let anything hold us back or stop us," Liar said before the season. Number 5. Can Ames and Washington lead West Fork back to a title? Last season, Caden Ames and Jacob Washington led a young, inexperienced West Fork team to the program's first state tournament appearance in 6 years. After the departure of 7 seniors, including All-State senior Zach Martinek, the Warhawks have moved up nearly the entire junior varsity squad to take their spots in the starting lineup. That squad made it all the way to the state semifinals, where they lost to Bishop Garrigan. This year, both Ames and Washington, who led the Warhawks in scoring with 401 and 333 points last season, are back, along with nearly the entire of last year's starting lineup. With a pair of standouts and a roster with a valuable year of experience under its belt, West Fork has a real shot at going all the way. Let's finish off today with the article, "Brandon Marshall Tries to Break the Stigma of Mental Illness." Brandon Marshall caught 970 passes for 12,351 yards and 83 touchdowns, owns an NFL record with 21 receptions in one game, and played in 6 Pro Bowls during a remarkable 13-year career in the NFL. His proudest accomplishment came when he sought to help for mental illness. "I have to go back to when I first realized that football wasn't my purpose, but that was my platform, and that was on the campus of McLean Hospital in 2011. Marshall said that the AP Pro Football podcast, "I was diagnosed with borderline personality disorder, and I just had phenomenal experiences learning who I was and just breaking down some of my belief systems. It helped me actually just become better in so many other areas of my life and inspired me to build things that could help people be better. So that's the thing I am most proud of, is the start of that mental health journey and the nonprofit side. You know, it's cool scoring touchdowns. It's cool making it into the NFL. That was an amazing journey. But when you are in a position to potentially save a life, that's a phenomenal experience." Marshall's transition to life after football following the 2018 season has gone smoothly. He launched a podcast called I Am Athlete during the coronavirus pandemic with former NFL players Chad Johnson, Fred Taylor, Channing Crowder. He started House of Athlete, a Florida-based lifestyle wellness brand. He's one of 4 hosts of Showtime's Inside the NFL and recently was named co-host of First Things First, a weekday morning show on FS1. But none of it would be possible if Marshall hadn't realized he needed to help deal with isolation and depression. I didn't have those skills to cope, so I had to go to McLean Hospital and join dialectical behavioral therapy groups, cognitive behavioral therapy, mentalization, self-assessment, Marshall said. I started with the clinical evaluation and neurological evaluations to see what I was dealing with, to see if I was capable of change. And for me, the journey has been really interesting, really impactful, and transformative. I just know that everybody deals with something. It affects us all, because if it isn't us, it's our neighbor. It's just important for us to be able to identify what people may be dealing with. For me, borderline personality disorder presented itself different than the people I was in the same group. So I am just thankful that I'm still here today to be able to tell my story and encourage others. Marshall wants to break the stigma that men should simply man up and suck it up when it comes to mental health. Real men face things, he said. You can't just face your strengths. You've got to face your challenges and your weaknesses, and it's okay to not be okay. And the best way to come out on the other side is to talk to people, ask questions, ask for help. Marshall said he continues to seek professional care. I talk to people when I need to, and I also try to stay ahead of it, he said. And I think that's an important part of our routine. We have a routine where we're taking care of ourselves physically, but at the same time and mentally, we're being able to deal with stress, especially now that there are people dealing with anxiety and depression for the first time ever because of racial tension because of COVID-19. Marshall began his career with Denver in 2006 and played for Miami, Chicago, and the New York Jets and Giants and Seattle. He had episodes of volatile behavior early in his career that affected his relationships with coaches, teammates, and others before getting his life under control. It was just a lot of highs and a lot of lows, but I'm just glad that I was able to turn things around halfway through my career to be a guy that people can lean on and depend on, Marshall said. My life was a living hell. It was a struggle. But I think the biggest thing for me was what people didn't see. It was the anxiety that I didn't even know I was dealing with. It was being uncomfortable in my skin, going to the gas station 100 degrees outside in Miami, having a hoodie on and bending down and moving in a way that people won't recognize me and see me because I don't want to sign autographs because I was just uncomfortable. So there's a lot to it. It was one hell of a journey, but now I'm on the other side. And that does it for today's reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette for November the 29th. I'm your reader, Will Potter. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. Thanks for listening.